Chabo Ril One. Now, you were in Bangkok when war broke out.
Yes.
What do you remember of the first news you received of the outbreak of war?
The outbreak of war. During that summer, there was a lot of talk about trouble going on in the Balkans and that sort of thing. But we were a long way from the Balkans and didn't worry us at all. brought the declaration of war to the surface was a very extraordinary incident, as a fact. We'd been playing a series of rugby football games. You mustn't forget that the European population of Bangkok, of Siam, at this time was absolutely minimal. A hundred would cover the whole of the European population over the whole of the country. But nevertheless, we had enough English people to rake up a rugby football team. The Germans had a rugby football team. There was another mixed rugby football team, and we'd been having in our spare time when we had any. Incidentally, I might tell you that in those days, one worked 6.5 days a week. these lazy British exploiters, but we did. Never mind, that's got nothing to do with anything. When we had any spare time, we used to play rugby football up at the sports club. And during this season, the Germans had got an extraordinarily good team, and they'd beaten the English team, including myself. I always tell people that I've played for rugby football for England nowadays. It goes over very well with some people. And there was a mixed French and Danish team and so on. Anyhow, one by one, the Germans had beaten them. And as a final game of the session, the Germans had challenged the rest. And so, it was to be followed by a dinner at the German club. And so we duly played this game. We were duly beaten by the German team. And we duly congregated for the ordinary rugby football party at the German club around the bar, and after the bar, around the table. We were all seated around the table, mixed up, obviously. There was a German here, and next to him was an Englishman, and next to him was a German, and next to him was a Frenchman, and so on and so on. And we were starting. The rugby football dinner was very like other rugby football dinners have been from time immemorial. A rush at the bang at the door, and a runner from the, I think the first one to arrive was the French embassy, with extraordinary news of outbreak of war. And he was very quickly followed by another runner, which I think the Frenchman was the first, either the French, anyhow, both runners from both embassies, the French and the German, both of them arrived with a declaration of war into the middle of this rugby dinner. And none of the chaps here had ever seen a declaration of war before. We'd never thought of other chaps in those sort of terms. We didn't know what we ought to do, whether we ought to seize a knife off the table and plunge it into the next chap or what. But after a little bit of discussion, we decided that as far as we were concerned, the war was going to start tomorrow, and it wasn't going to start tonight, and party proceeded. That was that.
What was your personal reaction to the outbreak of war? Did you make any attempt to get into one of the armed services?
Oh, yes, well, before the war, as a matter of fact, it was over a shilling bet. I had joined the Naval Volunteer Reserve, who worked from that ship just below Blackfriars Bridge. Forgotten the name, just above Blackfriars Bridge.
President.
It wasn't the president then, it was something else. I'm not quite sure. In any case, I had belonged for a little while, only a few weeks almost, before I originally came out to Bangkok, so it was only a little thing. But nevertheless, I had belonged to the volunteer and the Naval Volunteer Reserve. Well now, the British legation in Bangkok published that they were calling up members of the Naval Reserve. There weren't any members of the Naval Reserve, but I went and showed up at the British legation without disclosing that I was Naval Volunteer Reserve. I didn't use that, and they shipped me off to Singapore as an AB, ordinary seaman, not ordinary seaman, AB, able-bodied, and I, as a fact, was the first The Germans were trying to get away. Actually, there was a gunboat reputed to be in the Gulf of Siam, and so the Germans could not get away. The ships wouldn't take them. Any ships wouldn't take them. And they were in the course of buying a junk with the purpose of sailing this junk up to Tsing Tao, which was the nearest German-occupied place. A bit of a thing to do, but you know, the usual German enthusiasm. And the Frenchmen were running around in circles, and they hadn't got away, and I, as a fact, was the very first proposed combatant to get away from Siam, and I will tell you that there was something of a party. And I was put onto the coaster, which was to take me down to Singapore, as I was detailed to do by the British legation. The coaster took me down to Singapore, where I went and reported to the fort. At the fort, they looked me up and down and said, "Well, what do you expect? What do you want us to do?" And I said I didn't know, but I supposed they probably would be sending me home. They said, "Don't be ridiculous. You know perfectly well how long it takes to get home from here. It takes a jolly good 6 weeks, and the thing will be over long before you get there. Don't be so idiotic. You get back to Bangkok where you came from. Don't be so fool." And so back to Bangkok I went.
What steps did you take after it became clear that the war was not going to be over in 6 weeks?
I went back to work in my job. But sometime, not very much later on, when it became obvious that the war was not going to be over in 6 weeks and that it was serious and we were getting serious war news, there also came from the British legation news that they had an application from London and they were to send home, they had authority to send home anyone that they approved of as being officer material, because officers were required at home, and if they could find officer material, they would authorize to ship it up. And so off I went again to the legation. And this time was shipped away down by a coaster to Singapore, and there joined a ship which was filled with, hadn't got any other passenger, it was being laid on by the government, I suppose, with people they'd collected from all over the East. There were people from Shanghai, there were tea planters from here and there, there were rubber planters from here and there, office people like myself and all that sort of thing, all on their way home, all selected by their various authorities as being possibly suitable for turn into officers.
What's your impression that most of the British people who were working in Bangkok made, like you, some effort to get back? Was it a general movement?
There were precisely two left on this. Precisely two of us left on this actual request. A chap called Squires, who was in the same firm as I was, and myself. And Squires came home, and he was in some Dorset or other regiment. I'm not quite sure what it was.
So there was no great rush.
There wasn't a great rush.
Now that you've decided to return to England to volunteer for one of the armed services, had the idea of the Royal Flying Corps occurred to you as a service career?
No, much too wild a thought. I had a bit of an inclination towards Bengal Lancers or something of that kind. I thought a cavalry regiment of some kind. But later on, when we went through the canal, there was a noise overhead, an unusual noise overhead, and everybody rushed out to have a look. And there, going overhead, was an aeroplane. Apparently, I think it was a French aeroplane, as a fact, and it was on some sort of patrol along the canal, I take it. In any case, there it was, which started an idea going in my head. And from, because I always had been, from a small boy in the Wilbur Wright times and those, and Cody days and all those sort of things, I always had been very, very keen about this flying business. And so from there all the way home, my mind ticked over on a thing which I'd heard about, which was called the Royal Flying Corps, which was going to be the thing I was going to shoot after. And so when I arrived back in London, the first thing I did was to go and report at the War Office. There wasn't any air ministry. There was no air ministry at that time, of course, naturally. I reported at the War Office, only to get a cold bucket thrown over me by being told that the Royal Flying Corps was a very exclusive corps, the frightfully hand-picked people in it, and the only people who could get into the Royal Flying Corps were people who were seconded from the regular regiments, and not only that, from the better class of the regular regiments. And so that was that. But I did pick up from the chap that if I knew anything about aeroplanes, did I know anything about aeroplanes? I had to admit that I didn't. If I had known something about aeroplanes, they might have had two thoughts about it.
Did this make you abandon your ambition to get into the
flight? I went home with a very long face and told my father naturally what had happened. And my father was a solicitor, and although I didn't know so at the time, he was, amongst other things, solicitor amongst other people for Wolseley's, the motor car people up in Birmingham, or just outside Birmingham. And he happened to know, being in touch with them, he happened to know that they were working on some sort of a contract on aeroplane engines. As a matter of fact, they were making the 70 Renault. 70 Renault was the kind of the standard engine which was put into anything in those times. And he gave me an introduction to the management in this Birmingham place, and off I went with the idea of putting in a little bit of time, picking up a little bit of knowledge about some end of an aeroplane, the engine to wit. And I put in, it might be a couple of weeks, in Wolseley's.
This period with Wolseley would have given you some knowledge of aero engines, but nothing about aircraft as such.
Oh, no. But nevertheless, after, I suppose, I was at Wolseley's for about a couple of weeks, and they were very, very nice, friendly people indeed, and they were interested in the fact it was a damn fool who wanted to go flying. That was something quite ridiculous. And but nevertheless, when I did finish my couple of weeks with Wolseley's, they came forward with a bright suggestion. They were close linked with Vickers at Crayford, and Vickers at Crayford were building the Vickers fighter.
That would be the gun bus, would it?
No, it would not be the gun bus, because the thing it is actually, but only the dregs refer to gun bus. Gun bus is a term which is definitely not used. We do not talk of gun bus. It is the Vickers fighter, sir, if you don't mind. It's just as bad as talking of an aircraft as a kite. You classify yourself as the same sort of person. The person who would talk about an aircraft as a kite is the same sort of person who would talk about a Vickers fighter as a gun bus.
Yes. These words like gun bus and kite were words popularly used rather than used by people who are actually professionally
popularly
involved.
Popularly used, but certainly not used by a single individual in the RFC.
Point taken. What did you do at Vickers?
And so I went down to Vickers, and most interesting, there for the first time I really saw an aeroplane close to, handled it, touched it, and all that sort of thing. And there were one or two things that stuck in my mind very much as far as the Vickers fighter is concerned. It was a fighter, as obviously as its name implies, and therefore was being built for the purpose of, with the intention of taking, standing up to fairly rough handling. And so the ordinary bracing wires, in the ordinary aircraft of the day, bracing wires were what we call piano wire, just ordinary single-stranded wire, with the bracing for the wings, the flying wires, the landing wires, and so on and so on. But in a Vickers fighter, because it was intended and had to stand up to, proposed that it should stand up to rough treatment, all these wires were steel stranded cable. Now, if you think for a moment that each of these wires has got to have a turnbuckle for tightening or loosening the cable, And the cable has got to come through the end of that turnbuckle and through the other end. That's two splices. Where it joins on to the aircraft at the bottom end, another splice. Where it joins to the aircraft at the top end, another splice. That is to say, each individual steel cable has four splices in it. Now, splicing a bit of steel cable is not anybody's job by any means. And there are four splices in one cable as a rough. As a rough, there are at least 50. There are at least 50 of these wires with four splices in each. That's 200 splices going to one Vickers fighter. Right. My interesting recollection about this is a whole complete bench of sailors that Vickers had picked up from the docks or from wherever you'd pick up sailors, and those sailors sat there and spliced steel cable around eyelets for turnbuckles and that sort of thing for the whole of their jolly lives.
What was the length of that production line? How many sailors were there?
Oh, that would be, I would be imagining if I said, but at least a dozen, I should say.